Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. The Miller Center of Public Affairs is blessed to have loyal and generous friends like Gordon and Mary Beth Smith. Gordon and Mary Beth Smith are here with us today in the front row. As a result of their philanthropy, we're able to offer every year a Gordon and Mary Beth Smith Forum on American History. And today is the third one that we have been able to offer as a result of their help. Our topic today is A Virginia Dynasty, James Monroe and the Presidential Elections of 1816 and 1820. Now, when many of us think of a Virginia dynasty, we would first think of the Byrd family or the Big Three of early federal Virginia, Washington, Madison, or Jefferson. And often neglected is James Monroe. To help us understand President Monroe's place in the pantheon of Virginia greats, we're fortunate to have with us today Daniel F. Preston, who is the leading Monroe scholar. Daniel Preston is editor of the Papers of James Monroe at the University of Mary Washington. In addition to publishing volumes of Monroe papers, he's published widely, including this book, James Monroe, The Illustrated History, which we will have available following the forum. Dr. Preston earned his graduate degrees from the University of Maryland and his undergraduate degree from Evergreen State College in Washington State. His many awards and recognitions include a Mellon Fellowship grant from the Virginia Historical Society. Please welcome Dan Preston.
Thank you for inviting me to come and speak here at the Miller Center, and thank you all for coming this morning. I was going to say evening, but it's not evening yet. I always check the floor before I speak. The first time I gave a lecture was a number of years ago, and they had the podium positioned so that the speaker was standing on top of a trapdoor. They didn't drop anybody then, but I always check just to be a little bit safe. In my research on the Jeffersonian era, I keep coming across the phrase the Virginia Dynasty, which refers to the 24-year period in which, from 1821 to 1825, when three Virginians, namely Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe, occupied the presidency. And I've been thinking about this term lately and what it infers. It usually suggests that Virginia and these groups of Virginians somehow had developed a system that allowed them to keep control of the presidency and decide who was going to be, who would be the president. It's not unusual to hear that Madison was Jefferson's hand-picked successor, that Madison designated Monroe to be his successor. And I've even heard a very well-respected scholar say that the pro-slavery articles in the Constitution were put there to guarantee that the Virginians would control the presidency, as if the Virginia delegation, you know, specifically James Madison, had somehow dictated to the other delegates what was going to go into the Constitution. And it's interesting that when you read this stuff that mentions the Virginia dynasty, it's always Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, and it's not Washington. Somehow he's above this, but then these other three somehow become suspect. So what I would like to do is look briefly at the elections of Jefferson and Madison, but more thoroughly at the election of Monroe to try to explain this notion of the Virginia dynasty. And what I would like to suggest is that these three men rose to the presidency not through any kind of special arrangement or monopoly of power, But because in these elections, between 1804, when Jefferson was elected to his second term, and 1820, when Monroe was elected to his second term, there was really no other candidate of a national stature that could really challenge them successfully for the presidency. Now, when talking about the founding generation, we always think of them as this group of extraordinary men. And there certainly were extraordinary men in that generation. But what I would like to suggest is there really weren't that many extraordinary men in that group. I mean, Washington's cabinet is an example. I mean, his original cabinet of Alexander Hamilton, Thomas Jefferson, Henry Knox certainly brought together these men of great talent. But then if you look at the cabinet at the end of Washington's administration, they had all resigned. The original cabinet were all gone by the end of 1795, and you end up with the likes of Timothy Pickering, Oliver Wolcott, James McHenry. Perhaps men of talent, but certainly not of the stature, not of the level of greatness of their predecessors. So who was there of presidential stature? That is, who was there that was well known enough throughout the country or who was considered to have the experience or the ability to lead the nation? Well, of course, there's Adams and Jefferson to start with. And although Adams was president in 1796, his defeat for re-election in 1800 basically took him off the scene. Alexander Hamilton would have loved to have been president, but being foreign-born, he was not eligible. Aaron Burr filled the prerequisites, but his overreaching in 1800, trying to usurp that election, pretty much took him out of the scene as well. John Marshall was certainly of that stature, but had no presidential ambitions, was much more interested in the judiciary career that he followed. Then there's Madison, and a much younger Monroe. And incidentally, you know, sort of talking about this time frame, in 1802, a commentator on Virginia predicted that someday Monroe would indeed become president. So very early, he's recognized of that stature, but there aren't really that many of them. So who else could there be? In 1804, who could challenge Jefferson for the presidency? And in 1808, who could challenge Madison? Former Governor George Clinton of New York, perhaps, but he was elderly, he was in bad health, and really not able to fulfill any presidential ambitions that he would have had. In fact, Clinton was nominated by dissident Republicans in New York in 1808, and incidentally, Monroe was nominated by dissident Republicans in Virginia to challenge Madison. But both of these nominations were more protest sort of movements aimed at the foreign policy of President Jefferson and his Secretary of State, Madison, than they really were serious challenges to this candidacy. And they really had no illusion of winning. There was the Federalist Party. The Federalist Party in 1804 nominated Charles Cotesworth Pinckney of South Carolina. Pinckney was a very, very able politician, but was simply not of the same stature as Jefferson. And in that election, the only state he carried was the hardcore Federalist state of Connecticut. The Federalists went with Pinckney again in 1808, and he did a little better, but not much, and was resoundingly defeated by Madison. Election of 1812 is even more telling. After 8 years of failed foreign policy initiatives against Great Britain, Madison led the country into what proved to be a very unpopular war, and it was unpopular from the very beginning. If a candidate would ever seem to have been vulnerable, Madison would have been in 1812 when he was running for re-election. As we all know, unpopular wars have cost more than one president his job. Even so, Madison was able to prevail. The Federalists, having suffered several defeats, didn't even field a candidate in 1812. Instead, they backed DeWitt Clinton of New York, who was nominated again by dissident Republicans in that state. Clinton did well in the Northeast because of Federalist support, but he really didn't have a strong national base, and Madison easily won re-election. And what it came down to was Clinton simply didn't have the national stature, the national reputation that Madison had. Jefferson won in 1804, Madison won in 1808 and 1812, not because there was any sort of arrangement they had made, any sort of lock they had on the presidency. They won because there was no one who equaled them in stature who could beat them. Now, it's interesting to note that in 1808 and 1812, opposition to Madison centered in New York. And this wasn't just a coincidence. And it stemmed in part from opposition to policies of Madison and Jefferson before him, but it had a lot more to do with ambitions of the New Yorkers. In the early 1800s, New York wanted to become the premier state in the Union, and New Yorkers made concerted efforts in a number of ways to achieve this. A lot of their efforts focused on making New York City the great city, the great port in the United States. And by 1810, they had achieved this. In the 1810 census, New York had surpassed Philadelphia as the largest city in the country. And it was certainly, by that point, the most important port as well. By 1820, New York surpassed Virginia as the most populous state. And then, of course, in 1824, the Great Erie Canal opened, and this was sort of a crowning effort in this drive. So if New York was going to be the supreme premier state in the Union, then it only made sense that the president ought to be a New Yorker. And that the president repeatedly was coming from Virginia, New York's primary rival, probably was particularly galling to them. So it's not surprising that in 1816, New York once again took the lead in trying to get one of their own elected to the presidency. Now, in 1815, it seemed obvious that James Monroe, who was Secretary of State in Madison's cabinet, was going to be the next president. Republican leaders liked Monroe personally, but by 1816, there was an increasing unease with having another Virginian as president. In fact, Monroe commented on this as early as 1813, that if he ran for president, a lot of the opposition would be not so much to him personally, but to the idea that once again a Virginian would become president. And it simmered for a while. By the spring of 1816, this notion had very, very wide currency. Now, this suited the views of the New Yorkers very well. And as I said, they took the lead in opposing the selection of a Virginian as the Republican candidate for the presidency. DeWitt Clinton was the leading politician in New York, but his opposition to the war, his alliance with the Federalists in 1812 had tarnished his reputation. So the New Yorkers decided to back their wartime governor, Daniel D. Tompkins, as their candidate for president. Now, during this period, candidates for president were selected by a caucus of the members of each party in Congress. So the Republican members of Congress would get together and choose a candidate. The Federalist members would get together and choose a candidate. It was a makeshift arrangement, but it was really the only apparatus in the country where representatives from all around the country came together in one place at one time, and therefore would be able to have a national consensus on who the candidate should be. By 1816, there was a lot of disenchantment with this idea of having a caucus choose. With the Republicans in the ascendancy, what it meant was whoever the Republican caucus chose for president as their candidate was going to be president, because that person was going to win. And the feeling was, why should a group of congressmen in Washington get to decide who's going to be the president? This was decidedly anti-democratic in a period when democracy was really on the rise. There were proposals for having a national convention, but these proposals were pretty much rejected on the argument that that a convention would be cumbersome, it would be expensive, and the people were already there in Washington, so just go ahead and let them handle it. So it appeared that the caucus once again was going to be able to make this nomination. The New Yorkers tried to win the nomination in the caucus for Tompkins. Now, whatever his virtues, Tompkins just was not that well known. He was known in New York, a little bit in New England, but beyond that, no one really knew who he was. And other congressmen in the caucus had very little enthusiasm for him. Instead, they turned to William H. Crawford. Crawford was from Georgia. He had served in the Senate. He had been minister to France for a couple of years. And at the beginning of 1816, he was Secretary of War in Madison's cabinet. Crawford was very popular with members of Congress who liked his conservative Republican agrarian politics. And he was ambitious to become president, so he seemed to be a viable candidate. The New Yorkers, realizing that Tompkins was not going to get the nomination, agreed to back Crawford, I guess on the assumption that a Georgian would be better than a Virginian, even though Crawford was born in Virginia. So if he was not an actual, anyway, they went with Crawford. Monroe had a lot of supporters in Congress, but the majority seemed to prefer Crawford. But Monroe presented a real problem for the caucus. Monroe was ambitious to become president, and there was no indication that he would defer to Crawford if Crawford got the caucus nomination. So what would happen then would that there would be a three-way race for the presidency. The Federalists had put forth Senator Rufus King of Massachusetts as their candidate, but the Federalists were weak, almost on the point of disintegration as a national party. So King's candidacy would have been inconsequential, and it would have come down to a race between Monroe and Crawford. In 1816, in most states, presidential electors were chosen by the assemblies rather than through popular election. Crawford's supporters in Congress thought that they could exert enough influence over the state assemblies to get Crawford elected, even if Monroe was the candidate. Others were unsure about this. For Monroe had a distinct advantage over Crawford, and that was that Crawford was very popular among his former colleagues in Congress, but he wasn't very well known outside of Washington, didn't have a broad national constituency. Monroe, on the other hand, was well-known and well-liked throughout the country. Throughout the course of his long public career, Monroe had built up an extensive network of friends, political supporters in all parts of the Union. There were comrades in arms from when he served in the Army during the Revolutionary War. There were colleagues from when he was in the Continental Congress and in the U.S. Senate. There were Westerners who remembered him from as early as the 1780s as an advocate for Western interests. There were merchants who had problems in Europe during the wars of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars, and they remember Monroe service to them as minister to Great Britain, as minister to France. And throughout the country, people more recently were aware of the great energy that Monroe had brought to the war effort when he was named Secretary of War in 1814, and the energy that he brought in those last several months of the war. Important people knew him personally, and the common people knew him by reputation. To him, he was a man of great experience who would look out for their interests. And he didn't really care one way or the other whether he was a Virginian or not. Now, I first became aware of this attitude toward Monroe a number of years ago when I was working in State Department records at the National Archives. In the State Department records, there are these files that are called letters of application and recommendation. And they're arranged by administration. So there's letters of application and recommendation for the Washington administration, for the Jefferson administration, Madison, and so on. And they are letters of application and letters of recommendation for appointments to civil positions. Now, looking through these for the Madison administration, what I noticed was most of the letters were addressed to Monroe as Secretary of State. And I figured, well, you know, this was just pro forma. He was Secretary of State. He was in charge of doing this business. But then when I looked at the letters for Monroe's administration, they weren't addressed to so much to Secretary of State Adams, but they were addressed again to Monroe, who was president. And I started thinking about this and wondering what was going on with it. And you know, what I concluded was people knew Monroe. And you know, if you're applying for a job, if you're recommending someone for a job, you write to somebody you know because you get a much better connection that way. So I saw this as very graphic evidence that all across the country, people knew who Monroe was and they saw him as somebody who they could turn to for help in these sorts of matters. They were Monroe's national constituency. Now, this was shown in a couple other ways in the 1816 election that relate more directly to the nomination. When the caucus finally voted, a number of members who had been supporting Crawford switched to Monroe and gave him the nomination. Those who switched said they did so because they were responding to the will of their constituents. What this basically means is, although the members of Congress may have liked Crawford, they knew that the folks back home were going to vote for Monroe. So that's who they went for in the caucus. Even more telling, though, is what was happening in the states. The Constitution grants the states the right to elect a president through the Electoral College. And at this period, as I noted, electors were chosen by the state assemblies. They weren't popularly elected. In 1815, early 1816, before the caucus met, a number of states passed resolutions, had state conventions having to do with choosing electors. Six states: New Hampshire, Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, Tennessee, Louisiana, all passed resolutions instructing their candidates how to vote. In Massachusetts, there was a convention of Republicans in that state. They all backed Monroe. The caucus in Washington maybe won at Crawford, but it was clear out in the states Monroe was clearly the favorite. Now, one has to wonder what the Crawfordites were thinking here. You know, sort of, did they really think they could prevail in a three-way race that pitted Crawford against Monroe and King? And so what I've done here is something that we see a lot of, and we've seen a lot of recently, and that is counting states. And if we start out for Monroe, he had the six states that were more or less pledged to him to start with. And then he would take Virginia. And Kentucky, which was a Monroe stronghold as well. North Carolina, Maryland as well. Then there were the two other Western states. There was Ohio and Indiana. As I mentioned before, Monroe was very, very popular in the West, going back to the 1780s when he had been a leader in the fight to secure navigation rights for the Westerners on the Mississippi River. So these same sentiments that led Tennessee, Louisiana, and Kentucky to back Monroe would have brought Ohio and Indiana into his camp as well. Vermont backed Madison in 1812 when all the other New England states supported Clinton. So one could assume that Vermont probably would have gone with Monroe as well. King, on his part, could count on the Federalist states of Massachusetts, Connecticut, Delaware, and possibly New Jersey. Now, then there's New York. As much as the New Yorkers didn't want another Virginian to be president, it's hard to imagine them voting for Crawford against Monroe. I mean, they really had nothing to gain from it except spite. That wasn't much of a reason to really back a presidential candidate. Furthermore, even though there was this anti-Virginia feeling in New York, there was a very, very strong pro-Monroe faction in that state. So I tend to think New York probably in the end, if there was a race between Monroe and Crawford, would have gone with Monroe. The best Crawford could have hoped for would have been maybe a split in the New York electors, where he would pick up a few of them, but possibly not. And one wonders about Rufus King. Rufus King was from New York. If New York didn't want to vote for the Virginians, would they back King, who was by birth a New Yorker? But it's hard to imagine New York voting for a Federalist in 1816. So I would think New York would pretty much be safely in that column. That leaves Crawford with Georgia, his home state, which probably give to him. So if this scenario had come to pass, Monroe would have had 14 states with 167 electoral votes, King would have had 4 states with 42 votes, and Crawford would have had 1 state with 8 votes. This would have made Congress and the caucus look really bad, that their candidate not only lost to the other Republican, but came in behind the Federalist. This would have been major, major embarrassment. So the only thing I can figure is that the Crawfordites really believed that if they nominated Crawford, that Monroe would withdraw. But it never came to that. Monroe was the candidate, and he easily rolled to victory, carrying 16 states with 183 votes to the 3 states that went for King with 34 votes. And again, Monroe, being from Virginia, had nothing to do with it. Now, as we all know, Monroe was reelected without opposition in 1820. The Federalist Party was defunct as a national entity, and the Republicans, seeing Monroe's election as a foregone conclusion, saw no need to have a caucus, and so there was no official nomination. But what's interesting to note is by 1820, there was a whole host of presidential aspirants who did have national stature. Secretary of State John Quincy Adams, Secretary of War John Calhoun, Crawford, who was Secretary of Treasury in Monroe's cabinet, Speaker of the House Henry Clay, and then, of course, General Andrew Jackson. But they all knew that Monroe was very, very popular. And also, a lot of them, most of them, were very loyal to Monroe. Certainly Adams, Crawford, probably Jackson were, and simply would not have thought of challenging Monroe for re-election. But most of all, they all knew that they couldn't beat Monroe, that Monroe was a shoe-in to win. So rather than squander any political capital they had in a fruitless effort in 1820, they simply deferred their ambitions until 1824, when Monroe was no longer on the scene, and then it would then be a contest among these groups of new men. Okay. So was there a Virginia dynasty? In the sense that three Virginians occupied the presidency for a period, a successive period of 24 years. Yes, there was that. But in the more precise sense of the word of a dynasty, that is an arrangement in which people in power contrive to pass power on to members of their family, their clan, their group, what have you. No. Jefferson exerted no influence to secure Madison's election. Neither Jefferson nor Madison made any effort to support Monroe in 1816 when his nomination was challenged. Rather, Monroe's support came from outside the Capitol. I mean, sort of, if there was a dynasty, one would think that the power elite at the center would support the candidate that prevailed, and the challenge would be from outside. In this case, it was just the opposite. The power elite supported one candidate, but the person who was supposedly of the dynasty won because his support was from across the country in a much broader constituency. So in 1816, 1820, Monroe was elected just as Jefferson and Madison had been before him, simply because they enjoyed a national stature and a reputation unequaled by anyone who sought to challenge them. Monroe did not inherit a place in a dynasty, but rather he won election to the presidency simply because he was the best candidate. Thank you.
I'm going to move to the back of the room and invite those who have questions to join me in the back of the room, and we have time for a few questions of Dr. Preston. Let me begin the conversation by pointing to an area that you didn't really touch on in your opening remarks, and that is Monroe's term as governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia. What do we need to know about his service in Virginia? What was remarkable? And how did he leverage that experience into his two terms as president?
He actually served as governor of Virginia twice. He was elected the first time in 1799 and served three successive one-year terms. Governor was elected by the assembly for a one-year term, could serve three terms consecutively. So Monroe served 1799 through 1802. Then in 1811, he was again elected governor, but served only a couple of months because he was then appointed Secretary of State in Madison's cabinet. The first thing, I suppose, that would come from his years as governor was certainly administrative experience. Monroe was governor at a time that Virginia was building a first penitentiary, it was building an armory, it was at the time of a slave insurrection, and there was a lot going on that required a lot of good administrative skills. And Monroe proved to be a very, very good administrator, something that proved to be valuable to him as president. But it was one more instance of him serving the country. Monroe was in public office almost continuously from early 1776, when he became a lieutenant in the Continental Army, until he left the president in 1825. And it was just successive. You know, Army, Continental, or Virginia Assembly, Continental Congress, U.S. Senate, foreign minister appointments, governor, more foreign appointments than in the Madison's cabinet. So he was constantly in the spotlight as a public official in very, very important positions. And the governor was just one more of these, but something that broadened out his diplomatic and his legislative experiences.
Dan, thanks for your comments. I'm interested in his administration, Monroe's administration. I think every Virginia student knows the Monroe presidency for the proclamation of the Monroe Doctrine. I'd be interested in your assessment of how effective his proclamation was during the 19th and 20th centuries, and whether you think it still has any viability today in light of the Russian-Venezuelan naval exercises off the coast of Venezuela today.
That's not a loaded question, is it? At the time the Monroe Doctrine was announced, it had no immediate effect. That is, the roots of the doctrine was that the many of the Spanish colonies in America had successfully revolted and won their independence, and the United States had recognized that independence in 1822. Spain did not recognize that independence and wanted to reassert control over these colonies. And at the suggestion of Great Britain, the Americans began to consider somehow opposing any possible attempt by these by Spain and its allies to reassert control over these newly independent nations. Nothing came about on the Spanish part because the British had extracted a promise from the French that they wouldn't help the Spanish, so that diffused the issue. But Monroe went ahead and in his annual address, his State of the Union address, enunciated what became the Monroe Doctrine. And very briefly, my take on it is that what Monroe was saying was the countries in the New World tending to become republics like the United States had been, monarchy was still dominant in Asia. And what he wanted to do was basically draw an ideological line between the monarchies of Europe and the new republics of America. And what he said is any attack on any republic is an attack on all republics. That it's not so much Spain moving against Colombia or Argentina, but it's monarchy moving against republicanism. And that's what he was opposing. Beginning in the 1840s, American policymakers started pulling up this notion and using it, not in that same sense, but more as a policy for protecting American interests against European encroachment. Whether it was for, you know, it was used in Hawaii, of all places, in Mexico, Texas, and then later in the Caribbean and in South America. And the meaning really changed, beginning in the late 19th, early 20th century, around the time of the Spanish-American War, and then later. The doctrine was used as a statement of America, of defending America's sphere of interest. That is, that Latin America, South America, Central America were in a sphere of influence that the United States was exerting, and it was too close to home for there to be any European incursions, and the United States would oppose these sorts of things. My take on this is that World War I ended the Monroe Doctrine, simply because the Monroe Doctrine had three parts. One was that the United States would consider any effort to reconquer independent countries as a threat, that there would be no new colonies in the Americas. But the third point was the United States would maintain its traditional policy of neutrality in European affairs. Okay? Basically, you stay out of our business, we'll stay out of yours, that there is this demarcation. And it's a package. It's these three things all together. And if you abrogate one part of the package, then the whole package goes. So by the United States taking part in the European War in beginning in 1917, I would think that would eliminate justification for trying to enforce the other parts. Now, it's still used, and people still, I mean, even recently for Iraq, the Monroe Doctrine was brought out, and there are people who very much disagree with me on this and insist that the Monroe Doctrine still is a viable tool. So it's there, and its meaning has changed immensely, And you know, sort of just sort of what exactly it is depends on whoever is wielding it wants it to mean anymore.
I'm curious about the relationship between Madison and Monroe. You argue that Madison did not lend any particular support to Monroe in his election in 1816, but what is known about them personally that you can tell us?
Well, there's two things on this. First of all, once a president, there's a couple of fantasies that they presented, and one was that retired presidents would not exert any influence over subsequent politics, and they wouldn't use their influence to do things like influence appointments. And in fact, Jefferson and Madison, when Monroe was president, had this little piece of paper printed up that they would, if somebody wrote to Madison or Jefferson and said, would you recommend me for a position? They would send out this little piece of paper saying, because of our relationship with the president and our position as past presidents, we're not going to do this sort of thing. But if they wanted to do it, they did. You know, there's plenty of instances of where Jefferson and Madison wrote to Monroe recommending someone for appointment. So there was this notion that the past presidents don't get involved in this. And Monroe, as far as I know, never really much talked to Madison or Jefferson during this period. In 1824, when Monroe was leaving the presidency and there was this mad scramble, he bent over backwards trying to avoid showing any favoritism for anyone. In fact, you know, he wrote to his attorney general, William Wirt, and said, you know, sort of, you should come visit me at my home in Virginia, you being the only member of the cabinet who's not running for a certain office. So there was this, they tried to put up this wall so that the former presidents didn't appear to be electioneering for anyone. Personally, their relation was on and off. They were not really close in age, but they were on a similar political track. And a lot of times they found themselves in competition, and this caused some strains in their relationships. But generally they were strong political allies, but very, very close friends. There was a few rocky places here and there, but by and large, they were very close. And in fact, Monroe's wife died in Virginia in 1830, and Monroe then went to New York, of all places, to live with his daughter who lived there and intended to return to Virginia. But after several months, he realized that his health was so bad that he was never going to come back to Virginia. And he wrote Madison a very sort of sad, almost maudlin letter, I'll never see you again, I'll never see Virginia again, this sort of thing. But Madison was the only one he wrote to, you know, on that sort of subject, which sort of underlines, you know, just sort of how really strong their friendship was.
I'd like to ask about John Adams. I'm just reading American Creation by Ellis, where he feels that Adams in his later years undermined and belittled Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, Hamilton, he hated, and Paine. And I'm wondering, John Quincy Adams is the Secretary of State and John Adams in his last years, but I wonder what was his feeling about Monroe? Maybe it was too late for him to have an opinion. I don't know.
Monroe and Adams fought a lot when Adams was president. There was a very bitter exchange of letters between them. Interestingly, when Monroe appointed John Quincy Adams Secretary of State, John Adams liked Monroe a lot. And in fact, at this time, Monroe was in Massachusetts, and he had dinner with the Adams at Baintree, and they got on very well. But then later, Adams had some acerbic comments to make about Monroe. So I think it was just his general acerbic personality coming out that you know, he kind of grumped about everybody.
Why was it that Jefferson was not on the picture, on the scene in 1808, and Madison not on the scene in 1816, and Monroe not on the scene in 1824? Granted, Washington did establish somewhat of a tradition, I guess. I don't know how you establish a tradition with just one person, but of only serving two terms. But was there any talk at all about any of those three serving a third term? Did they consider it? Was it just considered not a thing to do? What's the story on that?
It was pretty much the Washington tradition that there would be two terms. And I think particularly this resonated well with Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe, and particularly Monroe, because one of his criticisms of the Constitution at the time it was ended was that, at the time it was written, was that it left the presidency open-ended. And he wrote an essay that he never published, but he went into this argument about how you can maybe have, and he was clearly talking about Washington, that you could have a man of great character and reputation become president, but if he surrounds himself with the wrong sort of people, then they could lead this person astray, get him to pursue policies, and get him to do things he wouldn't normally do, like maybe just sort of stay in office for life. So they saw this as a threat, so they were all very, everybody was happy when Washington bowed out after two, and they saw this as a good precedent. But I think it was a precedent that particularly resonated with them because they really saw a danger of a president for life that they very much wanted to avoid. So they were more than happy to take care of this, to take advantage of this precedent that Washington had set.
Yes. How much? excuse me. How much support did Monroe actually give to the American Colonization Society and the formation of Liberia?
We were talking beforehand about topics for study on Monroe subjects, and sort of every question so far has pretty much been a whole other lecture, or maybe a whole other book. American Colonization Society is one of these. There's a lot done. Very, very briefly. Monroe wanted to see slavery ended in the United States. The problem was how do you do it? Specifically, the problem was what to do about the freed slaves, who most Americans would not be willing to accept as fellow citizens. So what do they become? If they're slaves, then they're in a category by themselves. But if they're not slaves and they're not citizens, what are they? And so what do you do with this class of people? Well, the solution was to have them go somewhere else and you establish some place for the, so you free the slaves and allow them to go live somewhere else and establish a society, a community for them there. The American Colonization Society was a private effort to establish just such a place. And there were all sorts of motives for doing this. Some wanted to get black people out of the United States. Others, like Monroe, saw it as an incentive toward emancipation. Monroe's contribution to it was a little bit direct. He was a member of the Colonization Society. He was president when it was chartered. But what he did specifically was in, I need to remember the year here, 1818, the United States declared the slave trade to be an act of piracy, which meant that ships of any nation could stop any ships suspected of being slavers because they were now pirates and they were outside the law. And the arrangement was that American ships, British ships, whatever, who stopped a slave ship could then take that ship back to Africa and release the captured Africans and resettle them. And to further this process, the law provided for the Navy to have agents in Africa to aid in this resettlement. So when a slave ship came back in, there would be somebody who would help them get back to wherever they would want to be. What Monroe did is he allowed the Colonization Society to name who these agents would be. So what Monroe did is he appointed American colonization agents as Navy agents to be on the federal payroll to assist in this repatriation of freed slaves off the slave ships. Now, it never came to much, one, because they weren't stopping that many ships, but also, the agents all died within a couple of months of arriving in Africa. So it was never really implemented, but he did that step of using what power he could of the national government to help with this resettlement. And because of this, because of just his general association with the colonization society, they named their city Monrovia after him.
Could you discuss the relationship between Monroe and John Quincy Adams? Because many historians feel that John Quincy Adams was the person behind the Monroe Doctrine. And is this true that it was never ratified in Congress? It was just a statement that Monroe made to, I guess, one of his, maybe inaugural speech?
It was announced in his annual message to Congress, a State of the Union message. So it wasn't an act of legislation. It wasn't anything he submitted to Congress. It was simply something that he announced as a policy of his administration. Adams. All right, I will say it. I think John Quincy Adams is the most overrated person in the early history of the early United States. Now, Adams would disagree with me, and if you read his diary, he would tell you all the reasons why he's the smartest person in the world. A lot of what we know about the Monroe presidency comes from Adams's diaries. He kept very, very detailed diaries of events. His grandson selected parts of them, published them, and sold lots of copies, so that there are copies of Adams's diary all over the place. Scholars use them all the time. And when people study Monroe's presidency, usually what they look at is Adams's diaries. And in the Adams story, Adams is always right. He's always the smartest person in the room, and he's the one making all the decisions. If you look at the correspondence between Monroe and Adams, it's a very different story of where Monroe is constantly keeping Adams in line. And Adams will propose doing something, and Monroe will correct what he's doing. To relate this to the Monroe Doctrine, Britain made this proposal that the United States and Great Britain issue some sort of joint statement against the Spanish reoccupying South America. As was his wont, Monroe asked everybody he knew about it. He wrote to Jefferson, he wrote to Madison, he talked to his cabinet members, and he said, "What do you think about this? What do you think we ought to do?" He got all sorts of different opinions on it. And a lot of people thought the U.S. should go along with Great Britain. Adams and said, you know, sort of maybe we should do this on our own. After all, if we do it, it's going to look like Great Britain doing it, and we're just tagging along. Monroe was tending to go this direction, so he convened the cabinet, and he said, let's work up this statement of what we're going to say. And there was this free-flowing cabinet debate about it. Now, what Adams was thinking in all of this was they were going to be diplomatic notes that he, as Secretary of State, would send a note to the Spanish, to the French, to the British, to the Russians, and all over, saying, this is our policy. And these would all go out over his name, and they would get printed in a newspaper in his name. So it would be Quincy Adams doing it. Monroe pulled the rug out from underneath him by putting it in his annual message. So it wasn't the Secretary of State enunciating this, it was the President of the United States saying it in his annual message to Congress. And he took everybody by surprise for doing this, because it was simply something they were not thinking about doing. And it gave the messages, it gave the Monroe Doctrine, what became the Monroe Doctrine, a lot of extra weight, because it wasn't just the Secretary of State sending a diplomatic note to a foreign ambassador, it was the President putting it in his annual message to Congress. So personally, they got along okay. This image of Adams being the power behind the throne is completely wrong, and it's propagated by the Adams Lottery. And if in my lifetime I can counteract this in any way, I will feel my career has been a success.
We will try to avoid including Monroe in any discussion of a Virginia dynasty, and we will be grateful for the way you have helped us clarify our understanding of Monroe's very important place in our early history. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure.